Hey, good evening. It's Tuesday evening, July 29th. As our Feldman is here, tonight's cheer is sponsored by the Ice family, Arlene and Arthur Ice, to commemorate the yard site of Arthur's father, Pinchas Ben Yaakov Usher.
Okay, good evening. A few caveats before we start. I'd like to talk tonight about the topic of Tfilas Kelim, which is a topic that comes out of this pastor's parsha. The extent to which it comes out of, we'll see, is a topic of major debate. There are a lot of debates within this issue. And to that extent, I first want to say that nothing I'm going to say should be necessarily relied upon by Halacha or Maisha. It's a very practical topic, and I'm not going to try to issue any definitive halachic ruling. Just want to bring up some of the issues and maybe look at a little bit of the structure in which we could see this concept and talk about that a little bit tonight. And even as far as listing the issues, we probably won't cover them all tonight because there's quite a few. And we have to end a little bit early, so we'll set out some of the issues tonight. Again, no one should rely on anything Lelachol HaMaisha. And possibly sometime in the future, we'll maybe revisit it and add a little bit more to it. But just as by way of introduction and getting our feet wet a little bit, no pun intended, there is a obligation of Tfilas Kelim, which sounds like it comes out of this pastor's parsha. This pastor's parsha, so we read about the Kelim that were obtained from Midjan, and we know that we learn from there the kashering process. The Torah tells us that whatever was used with fire, whatever was used for cooking, has to go through fire, and that the first step towards understanding how we kasher kelim. And then in that same context, so the Torah makes reference to immersing it in mei nida, which is another way of saying the water in which a nida is tevelished in other words, in a mikvah, even though there are differences between the requirements of the tefillah of a kli and the tefillah of a woman. Nonetheless, there is this level of comparison, and the Torah says that it should go through mei nida as well. So does that mean that there's an obligation all the time to take all the utensils that are ever obtained from non-Jewish sources and to be told to them, to immerse them, that that's a mitzvah min ha-Torah? So the truth is, it's a very murky question, that a lot of the Rishonim felt yes, and the Rishonim thought no, that this this idea of tzvila, separate from the kashering process, is a din d'rabbanan. And to keep everything as confusing as possible, to keep everything as unclear as possible on this issue, so first we have the Rambam. The Rambam says that it's midivrei sofrim. And that expression, midivrei sofrim, is often understood to mean that it's the Rabbanan, but it's also not clear that he means that. The Rambam uses this expression, divrei sofrim. I think we mentioned in the past, at least one whole volume is written about this topic, about just that phrase means. It sounds like we use sofrim to refer to Chazal. Chazal called sofrim because they had such esteem for the Torah, they counted every letter, so we refer sometimes to the rabbis as sofrim. So it sounds like we say divrei sofrim, it sounds like it means this institution of the rabbis. But the problem is, it's not always clear that that's what the Rambam means, and there's some indications, at least in other contexts, that what he means is that it's a din which needs the rabbis to explain. It's not necessarily explicit in the Torah. It's not the kind of halacha that we can just open up the Chumash and see. And we need the rabbis to teach us how it's derived or how it comes out of that. So then he called it a divrei sofrim also. So there's a lot of debate on top of the Rambam, just what does the Rambam mean? The Rambam mean to say the Raish, the Rambam mean to say the Rabban. So we have a couple of levels of questions. On one hand, it's machlokes to begin with. It's machlokes, what is the opinion of the Rambam? And then, even within contemporary Svarim, if you look at different Achronim, you don't find a clear consensus. There are those who say that Rov Poskim hold its Daraisa, and there are those who say that Rov Poskim hold its Rabbanim. There are some tallies that come up that the majority view holds this to be a din d'rabbanan. So that's a pretty important point that really remains a little bit open. Depends who you ask as far as what is the majority view, as far as what's your perception of the majority view on this issue. It continues to be a little bit of an open question. Does it say the Simus at all? No. but I don't think anyone says that. It's pretty clear in Shulchan Aruch that there is a din. The question of what the din is, whether it's a din d'oraisa or a din d'rabbanan, that remains open for a little bit of discussion. And there are a lot of sub-halachos within this, as we'll see, that have their own impact based on how you see it. So for the one interesting thing it wouldn't necessarily occur to you right away, is often we have certain boilerplate nafkaminas when something is d'rabbanan d'oraisa that come up in every discussion. So this is not from that category. But one of the issues that might be affected by this, as Moshe Sternbuch points out in his tshuvas, is the question of aluminum. We have aluminum utensils, so aluminum is a new metal. Now, one of the metals mentioned in the Torah, it's not a metal that existed in the world in the time of the Torah. And just to be clear, in the context of these tzukim, so the Torah lists six different metals. And it's assumed that those six metals are what the Torah is referring to. So how does aluminum fit in? So here, Sternbach has an interesting attitude where he holds that it can be more strict if it's d'rabbanan. That essentially, if it's d'oraisa, so then we could assume it's limited to what the Torah lists. The Torah says it's these six things, and if what we're doing is the observance of this din d'oraisa, so then that would be limited only to those six, and aluminum is apparently not on the list. But if we're saying that it's a later innovation, and maybe Chazal didn't necessarily stick to that language, maybe Chazal said anything that's metal-like or metallic or anything within the metal family, even in the metal that's going to be invented later, is going to be discovered later, so then perhaps aluminum could be in this picture. So it's an interesting nafkamin. Again, it's not from the standard point to get brought up in every derisha d'rabbanan issue, and it's also not in the direction you might think. So this question of whether aluminum should be included, here Sternbach at least is taking this view that if it's d'rabbanan, then yes, I'll take a more machmir answer, and if it's derisha, then perhaps not.
What are the six
members? Let's take a look at the pasuk in is there a chumash nearby? Okay, maybe I don't want to...
Here.
No. So look in the article to see exactly how they translate all these models.
I just curious, yeah.
Is there an article nearby? Sorry. Pasuk here, it's around Lamed Aleph. It's Lamed Aleph Chafiz. Thank you. The Pasuk says, it's in Bamidbar, it's in last week's parasha, Lamed Aleph Chafiz. Ach es ha-zav, yes ha-kasef, es ha-nechoshef, es ha-barzel, es ha-bdil, es ha-ofaris. Which Archgold translates as, only the gold and the silver, the copper, the iron, the tin, and the lead. So maybe if we're assuming that we're following this sofer din d'oraisa, so maybe it's really those six. Rav Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva. Rav Moshe Feinstein's tshuva is about the fossil. It has a couple of tshuvas in a row. And this is near a day. Chel Gimel on Chofetz. Chel Gimel will tell you he's got a couple of tshuvas that we'll refer to in the next few sentences. A lot of them end up a little bit unclear as far as what his conclusion is. But on this topic of aluminum, he assumes that it's not certainly not a part of the Din Min HaTorah, following that half of Sternbuch's equation. But he assumes it probably is included in a din d'rabbanan, that there probably is a din d'rabbanan to be tovel aluminum. Now the question is, a lot of the aluminum that we use is, not a lot of it, but a decent percentage of aluminum that you might come in contact with is disposable, is not meant for permanent use. So that's the next tshuva. Right after this, you have two tshuvas in a row. The first tshuva is about aluminum, where he takes his tshuva d'rabbanan. There's a sefer called Zichron B'Tzalel, which is a very... very thorough work on a lot of halachic discussions. So he has a very long piece about Tzilas Kalim where he takes a more machmer, and he thinks that maybe he could even argue that aluminum could be considered within the din d'oraisa. That even though the Torah is listing metals, maybe it doesn't mean that as a way of excluding anything that on the list. Maybe it means a way of saying that this is all the metals we know, the world knows about now, and if the world will ever know about more metals, then that'll also be in the list. But he didn't think that was so inconceivable to say, and he thought differently than Rav Moshe on this. Well, you can make a bracha on the Rabbanans also. Right, so that's Right, so Shembach might leave it as a suffix.
There's some other new metals out of town too.
Right, so then a new metal would basically enter into the same equation. So when it comes to the disposable tshuva, so the Moshe's next tshuva talks about that. It's also a little bit unclear, but the way he seems to be indicating is that for the most part you would not be immersing a disposable kli, assuming that that's because you just don't view it as something that would last. If it's the kind of thing that would last forever and could be used forever, just they're so cheap you don't bother, then he's not so sure. If it's kind of, I think the question also has to do with really is that a function where we say a tibur or a siman, is that the fact that you only use it twice, the fact that you use it twice shows you that it's the kind of thing that is permanent, or is it a question of usage? So that's a little bit of a later discussion. But basically Reb Moshe's stance here seems to be that if it's something that's really disposable, just it's not the kind of thing that's going to last, it's not meant to last, so then that would presumably not need tibur. If it's that it really could last forever, you just don't value it enough to keep it around, so then he wasn't so sure. Wasn't sure that was necessarily in that story. Right, so I guess the question is also how are we defining a category. When it comes to animals, so we know an animal is this and is not that. But maybe if we, this at the time was essentially the whole metal world, and the Torah is listing everything in it, so maybe the Torah is, if I were to list all 50 states, maybe that's my way of saying, or to use that example, if in 1776 I were to list 13 colonies, maybe that's my way of saying that's America, and now America means the 50 states. It doesn't seem to be the majority view, or the criteria of Moshe Kroy didn't necessarily accept that, and the Sternbach also felt that central to his logic that that was natural. So the assumption that that's not the case maybe is the more dominant view, but there are those who expressed the possibility as well. Probably Drabbanan.
Right.
Right. Probably, it just sounds like a level of Drabbanan we need to know. Well, it's according to Sternbach, it might be a little bit of a suffix about the bracha. Yeah. Perhaps. One of the other ramifications of Dereish of Drabbanan, which should be a question also, is also very practical, so very often people will tell their kids to go take the kli to the mikvah and immerse it. So the truth is, it's a little bit of a question as far as trusting them, because the Gemara says in the beginning of Tzachim, there's a whole question of whether you can trust a katan, if you trust a child, whether it, when he comes back and says, I did it, are you able to trust that he knows what he's talking about? So often the distinction breaks down on the Reish of the Rabbanan line, but if it's a matter of Torah law, so then we require a little bit more backup to convince us that it was taken care of. If it's a matter of din de rabbanan, so we tend to be more makel, comes up in the context of the kishamim and other types of things. So that's a little bit of a discussion also, which would also flow from this derech of the rabbanan issue. It's also a question about plastics. There are those who raise the issue that when it comes to plastics, maybe we should say that you should be tefillah, because the concept of glass, when it comes to glass, the glass is for sure the Rabbanan. Glass is not metal. But a lot of things that we are tovo are glass, because there is a din Rabbanan to be tovo glass. And the idea is, the way the Gemara says it, is because if the glass were to break, so the way you fix it is similar to metal. You'll melt it back into each other. It becomes metallic as far as how it's brought together. The whole word mateches in Hebrew, we use to mean metal, has to do with the process of how it's be melted and welded back together again. So that similarity to metal brings glass into it, maybe I want. So maybe by plastics the same thing is true, maybe the same structure is true. So that might be the case, at least in theory, but the issue is also that it's not makabel tumah, and something that's not makabel tumah, so maybe is not a function of a kli, and not defined in that category, and therefore the mainstream view, even though there were those who disagreed, the mainstream view is not to see plastics as something that's included within the obligation of tefillah, again, even though there is some discussion. So what exactly is tefillah about? So what exactly is the idea meant to accomplish? So if you look at Rashi over here in Chumash, and you look also at the Ran and the Masechet Avodah Zarah at the end where the sugyas come up, so you kind of get the impression that this is actually a part of the kashrus process, a part of getting this edible, making this usable for eating, rather, the kalim worthy of being used for food, and to get rid of whatever non-kosher substances were used there beforehand. So maybe that process involves both the Haggalah, both the fire process, and also this process of immersion. The problem is that doesn't match a lot of the halachas that we have. A lot of the halachas that we have are not based on the assumption that they were used at all. And we generally assume that if the kalim were owned by a non-Jew, we've seen this both for Kula and Mechumra, because if the kalim were owned by a non-Jew and they were never used, they're brand new, so we still assume that they need tefillah, which you could say it's a kind of low plug, you could say it's across the board policy, but it doesn't necessarily, that's how you'd have to say if you think it's a kashrus related din, but it doesn't seem like it. We don't find other kashrus rules applying in that case. And on the flip side, we find many cases where you are able to use kalim that have not gone through this process, and if it's a kashrus concern, then that shouldn't be true. So it's a little inconsistent with some of the practical rules to say that kashrus is really what we're talking about. And what seems to be perhaps more likely is the way it sounds like from the Talmud Yerushalmi, that this is a process of conversion, that basically we are being metaher the pots in a spiritual sense, not in the physical sense, which is what the kashrus process is more about, physically removing any taste, any impact that the non-kosher food had. So that's what kashering the pots does. But here, this is about really making them Jewish, making them now Jewish kalim, which is a fascinating idea. And apparently it has to do with the nature of the eating experience. And the, because we don't apply this to other things, you don't have to kasher your telephone. You don't have to kasher, Right, so the idea that your utensils should be togel only in the sense of eating, and that's specific, that we only have a requirement by Rishuda. So that itself is a fascinating idea that presumably draws on the fact that eating is a holy experience, and that therefore our kalim that we own should be Jewish kalim, so to speak, that we have to convert them, and that's apparently part of the process. So that's a fascinating idea which could affect a lot about how we understand what this din is about. One of the discussions that we find, there is a discussion in the Rishonim that what if I want to do it the other way around? Let's say I have a kli that was used for non-kosher food. So I am obtaining this, like in the case of the Midian, I'm obtaining a kli from a non-Jewish source when it was used for non-kosher food. So it requires both Haggalah, requires to be kashered, and it requires tefillah as well. So the order that we find in the Torah is you're going to do the Haggalah first, and then you're going to do the tefillah afterwards. So is that makif? Is that crucial? What if I want to do it the other way around? What if it's more convenient for me to put it in the mikvah first, and then do the Haggalah afterwards? So Tosha says if that's the way it is, so then that's fine. Yeah, that's not a big deal. The order doesn't really matter. And a lot of other Rishonim aren't so sure. The Ran expresses the concern that we have an expression that a person goes into a mikvah. So in the times when Hilchos Tumah V'Tahara were observed, so say a man touches a sheretz, so he'd have to go to the mikvah to purify himself. So there's an imagery that we find in a lot of the halachic literature. A person is going to touch a sheretz and is going to go into the mikvah to become pure, and he's going to take the sheretz with him. He's going to go into the mikvah, he has the sheretz in his hand. So that expression, tovel v'sheretz biyado, is used in that context. He goes to the mikvah with sheretz in his hand. He clearly can't expect that to be effective. And we find it used as a metaphor in a lot of other contexts when people davening and kippur for forgiveness for things that you're still doing. So the literature says, tovu v'saretz bi'ado, you can't purify when you're still touching the source of impurity. So some of the sources find that that's, some of the Rishonim have this attitude as well, that we should say that when it comes to such a thing, that if you have food that has a blia system, that has a non-kosher taste still in it, to then try to convert it, to try to make it kosher, so then that's a tovu v'saretz bi'ado. So Tosus didn't have this view. Apparently Tosus maybe felt it was just a physical process that it all adds up to the same parts, it doesn't matter. And here you have a lot of Rishonim who seem to really feel that you have to bring it into a Jewish home, bring it into a Jewish sense, and if it has, if it still has non-kosher food in it, it can't reach that state. So there was a discussion of Dagom Rivava. It was written by the author of an Ode of Yehuda's commentary on the Shulchan Aruch. The Dagom Rivava writes that, however, if it's a situation where it's with the plate or the utensil is eino ben yomo, if it hasn't been used in that more than a day, so we find that certain halachas are more lenient in that case, so then we shouldn't have a problem of eino of tovu v'saretz bi'ado, and we should be able to do the tefillah first and kasher that part afterwards. And the Yad Shaul was written by the author of the Shilas and Shuvah, Shaul Lameshes. And in his commentary, Sopharas, he took issue with this because he followed the view of some Rishonim that even Eino Ben Yomo really is non-kosher stuff in the pot. It just doesn't trace up your food. So if you, it doesn't transfer to the food you might cook in it, but it still means the pot is essentially not Jewish or essentially not ready to be Jewish. Still, on a conceptual level, is missing its kashrus. And therefore, this whole logic of Tovu v'saretz bi'ado should still apply. A lot of discussion in the latest forum about this whole concept of Tovu v'saretz bi'ado, why exactly it applies here, does it apply here. Some point out, and we take this to the next step, let's say somebody buys a kli from a store, it was never used, it was brand new, and before he gets a chance to be Tovu, he somehow traces it up. He traces it up in his own house. He somehow does something to it that puts trace taste into it. So would you say that he's got to take care of that before the tefillah? We don't necessarily find such a concern in the poskim. So how far do we go with this? Do we go that it always has to only take place for kosher utensils? Or is it specifically that coming into this kind of conversion process, that if it still has its old lifestyle into it, it still has its own old non-kosher taste, and it's specifically then that it has to have Tara Dom before us? That's a discussion. Along the lines of this whole notion that it's more about the Jewish ownership of the kli than any kashrus concerns, there is a din in Shulchan Aruch that if you have a Jew and a non-Jew who buy a kli together, they buy a kli in partnership, so then it says it doesn't need tefillah. So some of the commentaries right over there that it's not clear what the din is, not clear what the situation is. Are we talking about a situation where they bought a kli from a non-Jew? Together, there's a non-Jewish kli, and together they bought it? Or are we saying that if it's a kli that wouldn't necessarily need tefillah, so let's say the kli that was new or was coming from a Jewish source, and a Jew and a non-Jew bought it together, you might think the fact that a non-Jew owns it also makes it need tefillah, so the din is not that way. So is that what it means? But it sounds like it means the first one, that even if they buy a kli that normally would need tefillah, so if the Jew and non-Jew buy it together, so then all of a sudden it doesn't need tefillah. So why should that be? So the issue of the Heter writes that the issue is that you're not going to be able to fix it anyway because it's half owned by a non-Jew. So you don't need tefillah because you're not going to be able to do anything. And some of the later commentaries said, I don't understand. But first of all, it's at least helpful what you can do. And so maybe we should say that you can't do that. Maybe we should say that you can't buy a cleat together with a non-Jew. How do you have such a halacha? So some of the latest Svarim explain that you see that it's not a din in the using of the kli. It's not really a kashrus problem. It's a concept that has to do with the Jewish ownership of the kli has to go through this process, and if it's not full Jewish ownership, if it's in a partnership, so then it doesn't have this requirement of tefillah, which is, again, a fascinating statement on what exactly is being involved here. So one of the major issues in general when a Jew does own the kli has to do with the problem of usage. So we normally assume that the kelim shouldn't be used before there's a tefillah. So what does that mean? Is that and Issa Deraisa, is that Issa Derabanan, is that Issa Aseh? So that's a topic of a lot of discussion. The Rambam has a language that, oh, you should bring the Kalim to be Tovol, and then they're Mutter to be used. So what does that mean? Does it mean that there was an actual Issa before that? Is it Issa Deraisa? Is it Issa Derabanan? The Torah and the Beis Yosef are more explicit in saying you shouldn't use it beforehand. Not just the passive, positive language of the Rambam, then you can use it afterwards, but they use in more negative language. But still, it's not clear. The Abnei thought it was just a question of a bitul aseh, of negating a positive obligation. And it certainly seems like it's not a, that's not Mr. Deraisa. So that's a big question when it comes to other people's kelim. And the question of whether that issur applies to people who might be fed from those kelim. So that's a very complicated discussion, because on the one hand, one could say that what is the nature of this prohibition? Is the prohibition, like the Chazanish had a discussion about this as well, do we say that basically it's a din in the Kli needs to be fixed, and so therefore it's a problem for anybody who's going to use it, or maybe it's the idea that it's the obligation of the owner of the Kli to fix it, and he shouldn't eat from it without doing that, because that's his obligation. So if that's the case, maybe one could say that if you're not the owner of the Kli, so you don't have the obligation, so maybe you don't have the prohibition. So there's a lot to discuss. There were those who took very stringent stances on this, and I think I'm certainly coming from a Lumbisha point of view, there's a lot to question about it, because there's a lot of Sfeikis and the Rabbanans on top of the Rabbanans as far as figuring out where exactly to go with that. And that's a complicated discussion. It's also complicated when it comes to restaurants, because strictly speaking, you find the din as follows. So let's say a Jew is allowed to eat from the kelim of a non-Jew without tefillah. So let's say he borrows kelim from a non-Jew, he doesn't have to immerse them. Let's say a Jew buys the kelim and then lends them to a Jew. So then the din is then that needs to be tovel, because the Jew who owns it needs it to be immersed, as opposed to the non-Jew. But let's say the Jew who buys it won't have to be tovel, because maybe he's buying it for a non-eating purpose. If it's a non-eating utensil for him, and this is somewhat subjective, this can be defined based on what the person himself does. So you can have a situation where, let's say, somebody buys utensils for business purposes. A Jew buys utensils for business purposes and then lends it to somebody else who wants to eat it. So that's a whole complicated discussion whether there's really an obligation of tefillah there. So the question of how one relates to restaurants, whether restaurants really have an obligation of tefillah, essentially they don't eat out of their utensils. They use them just for business purposes, and now the customers are essentially borrowing these utensils from the restaurants. There's a lot to try to figure out there as to what extent there is or there isn't an obligation of tefillah in that context. Extensive debate and posting. There's also a couple of other issues again we won't get into tonight. We'll keep it a little bit short tonight. There's also a question of this issue of whether you can use somebody else's kelim when it's not without tefillah. So it is generally agreed upon that it certainly doesn't affect the food, that any food that is produced in that context or that is removed from that context doesn't become trace afterwards. The only question is using it with the utensils. And there are others who write also that for children it shouldn't be a problem, because again, maybe the whole nature of yisr is very different than kashrus. Maybe it has to do with negating this obligation, and if it's not being carried out in that sense, maybe it doesn't necessarily have the same ramifications as far as children are concerned. It could also affect the question of whether tefillas kelim is appropriate on Shabbos, which is 2 days from Shacharis, and a whole discussion of labor sources, which also may go to the question of what exactly is going on. Is this what we call tikkun? Is this making them mutter when they weren't mutter before, like we find by Hafrashas Chala? Or do we say, no, it's not really central to the heter of the pot, it's just that there's a problem with using it beforehand, and that's something to also figure out. It's also a question whether a ger, a person becomes Jewish, so then is his kelim come along with him, or is he obligated to be told that all of his kelim knew now, because it's if he obtained them from a non-Jew. So all of that is part of the various multi-level discussions that can move this topic. And again, tonight is not intending to convey anything away, but just to list some of the issues and how they really do illustrate the fact that on the one hand, it's in the context of kashrus, but a lot of these halachas really seem to suggest that it's not really about kashrus, it's really about converting the kalim. And that raises the question then, so why is it only true about the food kalim? Why isn't it true about your phone and the computer and whatever else? And there seems to have to do with the nature of the eating experience, that the eating experience is something that we try to do in sanctity, and therefore we want that also that our kalim should be Jewish kalim whenever possible.
So did you?
Is there
a question? If you bought and kept dishes from
mm-hmm.
He is
used,
if
you're
not
a kosher, if you get a kosher, not kosher from a Jew, you know, not sure. Not sure what, there's an issue of Vodazara sometimes. There's a distinction between the Vodazara of a Jew and a not Jew. If they worship some idol.
Well, what's the discussion? Because this is having not kosher food from the Zara.
Not sure what that's about. Not sure what that's referring to. Maybe there's a specific, we'll take a look. I'm not sure exactly what that's referring to. But just to quickly review some of the topics that we did talk about.
Say, either rice.
Mm-hmm.
Could
it be love? No, not necessarily. That's why even if you say it's the rice, it could still be that using the kalim might still be a derabana. Or maybe a bit lasse, like the Avi Mezer expressed it, so maybe it's like a, right. Which is also the idea of a bit lasse, so Shlomo Zalman has a tshuva where he talks about the restaurant aspect we mentioned before. So he's not too excited about the whole schor idea, the idea that it's just for business and that they should be exempt for that reason. So that he doesn't really swallow so much. But he does think that there is a case to be made that you could say essentially the problem is being mevatel your own obligation to be tovel l'kli. And they're not going to let you in the restaurant, they're not going to let you get up in the middle of the meal and go run to the mikveh with their kalim. So we sometimes find that if you have a situation where the famous comment of the Bach, that's what it's called, among Avram, a person has a garment, a four-cornered garment, and it rips on Shabbos, and it becomes the tzitzis rips. So it becomes four-cornered garment on tzitzis. So the assumption is that, as is often quoted in a lot of later Svarim, you can keep wearing that on Shabbos because the reason you shouldn't wear it is because you have an obligation to put tzitzis on it. But if it's impossible for you to put tzitzis on it because it's Shabbos, and then you're not doing anything wrong by continuing to be in that state, so then it should be permissible. So you find similar logic sometimes being used here, and others weren't so comfortable with that whole approach. Even a lot of the Mechilim are not so comfortable with this approach, which is why they'll tend to only say that if you have to, and they'll also distinguish between different types of usage. And there's some types of usage where you really need the utensil in order to use it, for example, soup. They point out you can't use soup without a kli. And there's other types of situations where the kli is just there to be neat, but it could exist without. And that's also a distinction that's sometimes used here. On restaurants? I don't know if lachachila people make one. I don't think the hashgachas are usually, I don't think they usually make one that. But there's a whole range of attitudes and utilizes some of these ideas. So just to quickly review what we spoke about a little bit, so we spoke about the fact that there is this discussion in this past week's parsha about these six metals and about capturing them, and then this reference to Meinida. And many of the Rishonim understood from here an obligation in HaTorah to be Tovel Kalim, and the Rambam is unclear, the Bei Sofer, what exactly that means. Other Rishonim seem more explicitly to say it's a Derabana, and as far as who's in the majority, that's still an open question. Some say Rosh Hashanah holds the Derabana, some say the Rosh Hashanah holds the Raisa. And that affects a number of things. One of the less expected ones was the idea of aluminum. Rav Sternbach, for example, taking the approach that if it's Minas Torah, aluminum's not on the list. If it's Rabbanan, then maybe it means all metals. Rav Moshe, following at least half of that, assuming that aluminum is not a din Minas Torah, but likely is Midr Rabbanan. And then we mentioned that Zechron Bacal took the view that even it's it's still possible to say it's even Minhag Torah, then maybe the Torah was saying here, these are the metals of the world, and any other metal will also be in this group. Then we mentioned also the question that Moshe also had a tshuva about in the next tshuva, about disposable kelim, and how he distinguishes between kelim that just won't last, and kelim that would last, but you don't care enough to make them last. And we discussed the question of whether you can trust ketanim, and if you assume it's the rice, if you assume it's the rabbanim, how is that affecting? And the question of plastics, how does it compare to glass, where glass, we say, is the rabbanim, because of the like the similarity to metal and how it would be put back together if it would break. But it's clearly not a deraisa. And should we extend it to plastics also? And the majority of you seems to be the plastics are excluded because they're not mekabel tumos, they don't really fit the definition of a kli, whether or not they have any similarity to metal aside. And it's just a question of what is this obligation about. There's some Rishonim who sound like it's an obligation of kashrus, it's part of the kashrin process. And there are others based on the Talmud Rishonim and elsewhere, and also based on a lot of the halachas that we find here, that don't see it as a process of kashrus, see it as basically converting the kelim to Jewish ownership. And we talked about whether you could flip the order, could you put it in the mikveh and then kashr it? So Tosfos thought yes, and a lot of other Rishonim thought no. And more Rishonim than that also expressing this idea of Tovel B'Sharetz B'Yado, how that imagery might be relevant here. And we still have Nodi Yehuda saying, but if it's not Ben Yom, you wouldn't have that problem. And B.I. Shaul saying you would have that problem, because even if it doesn't trafe up your food, it still affects the status of the Kli. And then we talked a little bit about the question of Shutfus, when the Shulchan Aruch says that a Jew and a non-Jew who buy a Kli B'Shutfus don't have to be Tovel. So it's not clear, first of all, what the Shulchan Aruch means. Maybe they bought it from a non-Jew, they bought it from a Jew. So apparently it seems to apply even if they buy it from a non-Jew, so why should that be? So that it doesn't come into full Jewish ownership, therefore it doesn't have this requirement of tefillah. And then we talked about this idea of not using the kelim, how it seems to be from the language of the Rambam, the Shulchan Aruch, there's a problem to use the kelim before it's gone through tefillah. It's not clear what the nature of that problem is. Is it Nisa de Rabbanan? Is it a Bitul Asheh? And whatever it is it a function of the kelim, the kli is somehow not ready for use by anybody, or is it that it's the obligation of the owner to use to be tovel with it, and therefore he shouldn't use it without tefillah, but that obligation might not apply to other people. And we talked also about the fact that you could have a situation where a Jew is not obligated in his in being tovel with it if he buys it for a purpose other than tefillah. A whole discussion about how business could fall into that, and how that may affect restaurants, that they essentially buy their kelim for business purposes, and then the people who use it are essentially borrowing it, so one could make the case that nobody becomes obligated in tefillah at that point. A lot of poskim weren't so enamored with that, and I mentioned that Shlomo Zalman wasn't so enamored with that logic either, but he thought that there was something to be said for the idea that essentially it's their obligation and you can't do anything about it, it's not going to let you go out and do it. So maybe, again, not across the board, but maybe again there's some room to say that that's something that could be relied on. And then we discussed, touched upon a little bit more some of the questions of Geirus and the questions of whether this should be done on Shabbos and related issues. Again, there's a lot more to say about this. Maybe someday we'll revisit this topic, not next week, because I want to talk about Tisha B'Av a little bit, but maybe sometime in the future we can follow up. But just to call our attention to some of these issues. Sorry? Right. Right, so question what the status of that coating is. Right, so the coating, but the coating probably doesn't help. The question is if it hurts. Well, so if you have a kli that's something that's not tovel necessary, not normally requiring tefillah, and the coating is of something that is, so you put a metal coating on something that's not metal, so does that make it require tefillah? This is part of the whole China thing. Because the China syndrome here, that you don't have to, it's a great kula. The fact is a lot of people's heaviest kelim and most fragile kelim are in China, and the idea of going to the mikveh with all the China is a very unpleasant thought. So China, for the most part, is assumed to be exempt. It's not part of this list. So that's a great exemption. Only question is, we say that our China nowadays, is that real China, or is it that it's China on the inside, but it's got glass on the outside, it's got what is called glazed, and it has a glass covering. So if we assume that glass is obligated, maybe we should view our china as glass. That's how some thought, and others didn't think that was necessarily such a concern. Okay, stars next week, so we're Thursday night? Okay, so not Thursday night next week.
Yeah.
Okay.
You're up by 30, I think.
Yeah.